A Handful of Dust, a podcast about Neil Gaiman's The Sandman comic. This is just an extra episode. Back in 2018, we recorded an episode of Mega City Book Club, or rather, I was a guest on Mega City Book Club, and we spoke in depth about A Game of You. In our last episode, when we revisited A Game of You, we referred to that episode quite a lot, so we thought we'd throw it up here in the feed so that you could listen to it if you missed it on Mega City Book Club. It's just an extra discussion, it's not essential, so you can skip it if you want. And again, a content note for this episode, as we've mentioned before, The Sandman features dark and troubling subject matter, and we occasionally talk about them in the episode, so you can see the description for this bonus episode. We'll have more information about content notes for you. And we'll be back on Friday with the next episode of Handful of Dust, where we're talking about fables and reflections.
Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about collected editions from the galaxy's greatest comic, 2000 AD. I'm Eamon Clark, and nepotism once again rules on the podcast. I'm back in the study with my daughter, Jenny. Welcome back to the book club, Jenny.
Hello.
So last time we did Halo Jones.
Yes.
We revisited Halo Jones because it's already been on the podcast before. And before we move on to today's book, I wanted to ask you about a recent news item, the announcement that the Rebellion are bringing out yet another edition of Halo Jones in three volumes, this time coloured, with colours by an artist called Barbara Nascenzo. And we've got one of the example pages up on the computer in front of us as we're recording. Any comments on the colour in itself or on the idea of producing a coloured edition of Halo Jones?
I think we spoke about it last time and you said that for American audiences, stuff has to be coloured or else nobody will buy it.
Yes, this is what I've heard from Rebellion as well.
So I think it's an interesting concept to find a way to make your comic more accessible to a new audience. And I think, like, all the things we talked about, Halo Jones being like an important comic book for me growing up, it's interesting to think that that will be available for a wider audience.
Yes.
Also, I don't know if we talked about it the last time round, but I remember when I first read Halo Jones, those first chapters, the artwork is quite, well, it was very different from what I was reading. I was reading like web comics at the time. So it's quite a different style than I was used to. And I did find it quite hard. So actually looking at the colours now, maybe they make the art just a little bit more accessible in terms of like visually reading the page.
Yes.
Than that sort of like black and white, you know, it's like very, very 80s, like stylized drawings originally were, especially in like, I remember the reproduction that we had, the trade. It was quite a bad reproduction. And then the next one I read was the condensed one where the pages were quite small. And so there's like lots of different things that go into making a trade.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I know from listening to the 2000 AD podcast, or the Thrillcast, they've said this thing about when they show books to people at comic conventions in America, they can entice them in either with the idea of Judge Dredd or with the idea of a comic by Alan Moore that they've not heard of. But once people open the book and see it's black and white, they get turned off. So, you know, obviously, I mean, anything that gets 2000 AD comics and Halo Jones into a wider audience, I think, is a good thing. So I'm hoping that this coloured edition does that. They're bringing it out in three volumes, the three books. I'll certainly be getting it. I don't know how many versions of Halo Jones I've now bought. I think the other thing is, I suppose, is, as you say, some of the reproduction in various editions has been a bit iffy. And it looks like with, you know, their newer technology that Rebellion are now using, that the quality hopefully will be much better. in terms of reproduction. So yeah, hopefully it'll be a very nice looking edition, and hopefully, as you say, it will help sell in America. And I mean, we're looking at this example page from book one, coloured by Barbara Nascenzo. I think it's quite sympathetically done with Ian Gibson's artwork. It's not garish at all. It looks quite good.
Yeah.
Whether it tells us more about the story and the characters and the world, I don't know. But you thought that perhaps that them, you know, they might do things in terms of the way some characters are depicted.
Well, I think especially there are a few characters you can tell in the black and white drawings are drawn as people of colour. So it's interesting whether they were interested in whether they would continue that and expand that, because obviously, when you first meet Halo, she's in a slum. And the way we represent slums is always using people of colour. But then as she moves through, she meets people of colour throughout her journey. And so I think when you've got a chance to do colouring, there should, you know, I would hope that they're thinking cleverly about who they're representing and who they're like giving a chance to represent in this sort of very simple picking a colour.
Yes, idea. Yeah. I mean, yes, as you say, it may allow for it to be more representative and more diverse. There's, you know, diversity. There's the word that I'm sort of learnt from our last discussions when we talked about Halo Jones previously. Okay, interesting. So three books coming from Rebellion in the future. Another chance for everybody to buy Halo Jones, especially in the American market. But we'll see. So we touched upon it last time. I think we sort of trailed what was coming up. The book for this episode, we're following 2000 AD creators off-piste to another project. So tell us, what are we talking about this time?
We're talking about the collected volume of The Sandman called Game of You, A Game of You.
Okay, The Sandman, A Game of You, the fifth volume, if you're looking at it in trade collections, of The Sandman. Now, this is a 2000 AD podcast, so some of our listeners may not have read The Sandman. Let's do the overview, the whole thing. This is a 75-issue comic book by Neil Gaiman and a bunch of artists. It ran from 1989 to 1996. We're looking at six issues from the early 90s, issues 32 to 37. It's written by Neil Gaiman. I'll do Creator Corner. So we've got artwork by Sean McManus, Colleen Duran, Brian Tolbert, there's another 2000 AD name, Dick Giordano, George Pratt, Stan Wok, Daniel Vozzo. It was lettered by the famous comic book letterer Todd Klein, editors Karen Berger and Elisa Quitney. I should say that all the comics of The Sandman had wonderful covers done by a long-time art collaborator with Neil Gaiman, Dave McKean. And we'll perhaps, if we get a moment, just mention the covers and what he did. And then this particular volume has an introduction written by the science fiction author Samuel R. Delaney, which is an interesting introduction, which I think we're going to come back to. But okay, so Sandman, A Game of You. Why are we talking about this book? Why have you picked this one, apart from me sort of pressurising you to?
Well, it follows on from Halo Jones, or rather I think Halo Jones follows A Game of You, because it was one of the first comic books that you handed me when I was about 15. I think we decided I was about 15, 14.
Right, yes.
When I first started reading them. And it, when we were talking about Halo Jones, it sort of naturally came up, because it's from, well, I guess, you know, is The Sandman as a series was something that you collected, but it's also a sort of a female-fronted comic in the way that Halo Jones is a female-fronted comic in 2000 AD, which is male-dominated.
Yes.
And so I don't know if we really discussed this, whether it was a conscious decision that you made to give me stuff that was with female leads, or whether it's just coincidental that you were like, this is the one Jenny will like, because has female leads in it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, actually. I try and remember why I gave you these particular comics. I think it was probably because they were, as you say, they had predominantly female characters in them. And I thought it would interest you more than just, say, Judge Dredd or Strontium Dog or something like that. So yeah, I mean, we talked about it briefly last time. A Game of You is an interesting choice from the Sandman run. I asked you in the prep two particularly difficult questions. Let's get the hard one out of the way first. What's the comic A Sandman about? If you can answer that.
So many things. But I guess it takes this idea that Dream, or the Sandman Dream, as I think he's probably more known,
yeah,
is a real person who in some way controls or monitors the dreaming world, along with his siblings who monitor other aspects of your life. And using that as a jumping off point, I think what the Sandman is really about is about little bits of folklore and magic and fairy tales and literature that sort of have woven into a sort of public consciousness about pop culture and culture in general over the 20th century and right up to the very beginning of the 21st century. And I think, yeah, I think that's what it's, that's what,
yeah,
it's about.
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating comic book run. Neil Gaiman gets asked to create an ongoing comic for DC Comics. And I don't know quite how it happens, because DC had had a comic, had a character called the Sandman who was a pulp hero from sort of, I don't know, 30s and 40s. And he wore a gas mask and he had a fedora and a cloak and he had a gas gun. And then in the 70s, they had another character called the Sandman who was a Joe Simon and Jack Kirby creation, a brightly costumed character who again fought bad guys and monsters in the dream world. And it's interesting that when he comes to write this comic about the king of the dreaming, you know, the dream king, Morpheus, that he managed to bring in those earlier Sandmans along the way. So you get to see them very briefly. And in fact, I think the colourful Jack Kirby one is becomes a sort of plot point in the early part of the story. But as you say, 75 issues, it's about fables and stories and this huge arc and weaving in all these bits of mythology. It's very difficult to describe, actually, the Sandman, but it is fantastic. It is, you know, one of the great comic book creations, I think. Okay, let's try and narrow it down then. So we've got A Game of You, 6 issues. It's in the, as I say, it's in the 30s of the Sandman run, early 90s. This one perhaps slightly easier. What's the plot or, the basic characters of A Game of You?
So there's sort of two worlds in A Game of You, isn't there? There's the real world that we'd recognise as our own, and then there's a world that is a dream. And I think the real world characters cross over into the dream world, should we say, but the real world characters, roughly speaking, are Barbie, who's the lead,
yep,
who appears in both, Wanda, her best friend, and then the people who she shares a house with, Thessaly, Hazel, and Foxglove, and then a few other minor characters. And then the dream world, we have sort of magical fairy tale characters, and we also have Dream, obviously.
Yep. It's a tricky one in a way. One of the things about the Sandman comic over the 75 issues is that, and I put this in our notes, that Neil Gaiman doesn't waste characters. So even minor characters from the early arcs of the comic, they're important. They come back later on.
Yeah.
And so Barbie, who we'd seen in an earlier comic, earlier Sandman, who was, you know, in a sort of humorous twist, she was married to a man called Ken. In A Game of You, she's no longer married to him. You know, he's now married to Cindy. That's right.
Throwaway joke.
So, and here she is. You know, she was a fairly minor character, and we saw her dreaming, and we saw, I think, this dream world that she visits in her dreams.
Yeah.
And it becomes back in A Game of You, where she is, she's divorced, she's living in this New York building, she's got flatmates or roommates, who, you know, people who have flats in the same building, as you say, Wanda, Fox, Hazel, Thessaly, and an odd character called George. But she also has this dream world, this fantasy fairy tale world, inhabited by sort of fairy tale characters, where she is Princess Barbara. And when the story starts, the characters from the fairy tale world are looking for her. They're trying to get her back because something awful is happening to this fairy tale realm and they need the princess back. And one of the characters will manage to cross over because he has...
The Porpentine,
that's it. So the Porpentine is a dream stone, isn't it? Yeah. And it's got some sort of undefined power, which is, I mean, it's a bit like, dare I say it, for 2080 listeners, it's a bit like Judge Death's dimension jump, in it allows you to move from one world to another. But here it allows characters to move from this fantasy fairy tale land. I mean, we don't want to give too much away about the whole story, but it's strongly hinted that it's this fairy tale land is a land that Princess, or that Barbie, created when she was a child. It was her imagination.
Well, it's a land that she visited in her dreams, because I think it's crucial to sort of, maybe we'll talk about the ending and dream's sort of role in this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's her dream land, but also she created elements of it, and she took elements of her life and her real life and put them in there. So her toys.
Yes.
Are the toys.
Yeah, so she populated this fairy tale land with her toys, and her toys become the characters who in turn are trying to get her to come back and save the land because something awful's happening. I noted this because there's another comic book which is by two 2000 AD creators. It's by Ian Edginton and Disraeli, who are a great combination. They write these fantastic books. And they wrote a book and drew a book called Kingdom of the Wicked, I believe it's called, about an adult male who discovers that the fantasy world he created as a child is somehow real, and he gets sucked back into it. When I was writing notes about that for another project of mine, I sort of came across this idea of something called a paracosm, which is the idea that you create this fantasy world, and that kids often do this. They create these fantasy worlds. And sometimes it's just, you know, by yourself with your imaginary friends in the fantasy world, or sometimes a group of siblings would do it. And apparently, famously, the Bronte sisters did it. Apparently, Bronte sisters had this sort of paracosm that they created stories about when they were kids. But yeah. Anyway, there you go.
Well, I think that's interesting because when you're reading A Game of You, there's lots of literary references in it. It's not pretending that it's not referencing stuff. So Alice in Wonderland is like a key one. And I think that sort of feeds into that idea of a fantasy land. But there's also The Wizard of Oz. There's mentions of Lord of the Rings, but I think it also feeds into other things. Well, for me, I don't know, maybe other people read other things into it, but there was part of the fantasy land is named by Barbie as the brightly shining sea.
Yep.
And for me, that is the most Anne of Green Gables naming construction. Anne of Green Gables has the Lake of Shining Waters, and so her imagination is always Anne of Green Gables. Her imagination is always about, you know, making the ordinary into this sort of fantasy world. You know, it's just the ocean, but it's beautiful, so it gets a beautiful name. And that was a very sort of like, obviously, I read Anne of Green Gables as a child as well, so I think it, for me, that's what I was reading into it, this sort of like idea about a young child having an overactive imagination, or having a vivid imagination that they use or escape to, or just is part of their life. I think that's... Yeah, I think that's what A Game of You is all about, really.
Oh, that's fantastic. I hadn't thought of Anne of Green Gables at all. But, I mean, one thing that Neil Gaiman does in all his writing, particularly in Sandman, is he borrows from the best, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. You know, he does bring in elements from so many other stories, and his knowledge of sort of the various mythological, you know, tales from all around the world, and how he brings these things in The Sandman, and particularly, you know, we're going to be talking about it in A Game of You. Okay, so there's this fantasy land that Princess Barbara, or Barbie as she is called back to by this character, Martin Tenbones, who crosses over with the Porpentine, the magical device that takes her back to her fantasy land, which she thought wasn't real. And in a way, it isn't real. She's in a dream. But of course, that leaves her in a sort of coma back in real world New York. I say real world, you know, comic book world, New York,
yeah.
Where her friend Wanda's very concerned about her, and that gets Thessaly and Fox and Hazel involved as well, and they are trying to protect Barbie. Well, at the same time, Thessaly, who's an interesting character,
yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about the characters, about, you know, these other ones that we've got.
Well, I think what you said earlier about how Neil Gaiman doesn't let any minor character go to waste, I think that's really interesting, especially in this book where it weaves together several characters who've been mentioned in the past. And they also go on to have lives after this as well, some of them. So there's obviously Barbie, and I think the character who is second to Barbie is Wanda, is very interesting, and I think is also why we started talking about A Game of You last time, because Halo Jones features a trans character and A Game of You features Wanda, who's a trans woman. And for a lot of people, including, I think, myself, Wanda is the first trans character I ever met, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
I think probably my first experience, like, reading about a trans character. She's also a very good trans character, because she has a depth, you know, she has friends, she has a life in New York, she has family, she has a history. She talks about her transness, you know,
yes,
her embodied experience in various different ways. And the idea of her transness comes up and is crucial to the story. And I think that's very interesting. It's not a throwaway, oh, it's New York in the early 90s, so there's a trans character. It's very, like, she is fundamental to the story, and she's also Barbie's best friend. And I think we also talked about that in Halo Jones. These ideas of best friends are very important, and Wanda's, like, protectiveness of Barbie and Barbie's protectiveness of Wanda become central to the story as well, even though they are separated for most of it.
Yes. Yes. I mean, the story is about these two worlds, this dream fantasy fairy tale land, and the real world of New York, and how Barbie gets drawn over, and she's on a mythical quest to save this land. And as you say, it's got elements of Wizard of Oz and Lord of the Rings and all these sorts of things going on in it. But the characters, as you say, the character work that Neil Gaiman does, and this idea of friendship, because we know that Barbie, for a variety of reasons, had a rough time with her ex-husband, Ken. And we get the impression that Wanda has been very helpful and supportive with that. And in turn, you know, I think we're told quite clearly by Wanda at some point, Barbie just regards her, you know, as Wanda, as a friend. Mm-hmm. It just accepts her as a friend, and accepts her as a woman, a trans woman, and doesn't ask anything of her, you know, other than this amazing friendship they have and this sort of support they give each other. And it runs right the way through the six issues, I suppose, right the way up to the very sort of moving finale, which we talked about last time in our Halo Jones podcast, which is why we're here talking about it now, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, you know, because Halo Jones, first book, she has friends. Second book, she does have a friend. And in the third book, the friend comes back. And, yeah, her, you know, her relationships are quite interesting to look at. But Barbie and Wanda are fantastic as characters and as a couple of friends. I suppose we should mention we've got another couple in the house. We've got Fox and Hazel.
Yeah.
Who are a lesbian couple. And then we've got this weird character, Thessaly, who, you know, I'm going to give away spoilers, but it's hinted pretty strongly. Thessaly is some sort of ancient Greek witch.
Yeah.
Who's hundreds of years old. And let's talk about the villain of the piece. The villain of the piece in the fantasy world is a character called the Cuckoo.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us what about the Cuckoo, or just the idea of?
Well, yeah, because the Cuckoo is... The idea of who the Cuckoo is and what a Cuckoo is runs throughout the whole thing. This idea of someone who has taken over a space that belonged to somebody else and is masquerading. And so the Cuckoo in the dream world is a... I think it's going to be impossible to talk without spoilers, but...
No, yeah.
In the dream world, the Cuckoo takes on the role of a younger version of Barbie, who... So she is Princess Barbara at the time when Princess Barbara is dreaming about being in that dream world.
Yes.
And in the real world, the Cuckoo is in the strange downstairs neighbour George's body.
Yes.
That is a more real representation of birds, but also with George as like a shell for those birds.
Yes.
Who is there to observe, but also there to try and steal or destroy the porpentine that Barbie is given by Martin. It's like, it's sort of a complex idea, but he's becomes the way the story sort of opens up, the way we sort of discover what is really going on.
Yeah.
Is through the reveal of him being inhabited by birds and the way Thessaly reacts to those birds as well.
Yeah, so we got George. He's the creepy neighbour.
Yeah.
He turns out to be working for the Cuckoo. Either real or some sort of dream-like birds come out of his body. The whole house has fallen asleep. So Barbie's in some sort of coma because she's passed over into the dreaming. Because Martin Tenbones, this huge dog-like character, came over and gave her the porpentine, the magic device. And the rest of the house has fallen asleep, and George is the only one who's up. And these birds that somehow come out of him go and sit on the various members of the households and give them terrible dreams.
Yeah.
And they're all stuck in these terrible dreams because, you know, it's a book about the Sandman, about the Dream King. So, you know, it's appropriate that they're stuck in terrible dreams. But, of course, Thessaly reacts in a completely different way. Thessaly wakes up, grabs the bird, kills it, and then goes out into the house to find out who has done this. Mm-hmm. Thessaly will lead Hazel and Fox. Well, she takes all the characters into George's flat or apartment, I suppose, if we're talking about an American book, where they discover that Thessaly has killed George. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And Thessaly learns that the Cuckoo has done this. And it's quite interesting because Thessaly is... It's not like she's good or bad. She's reacting to an attack.
Yeah.
And she wants vengeance on the Cuckoo. Whereas Wanda wants to protect Barbie and Hazel and Fox just seem caught up in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not entirely clear why they do get caught up in it. But once they're in it, they're sort of committed to becoming part of the plot, I suppose, part of the Thessaly's plan.
Yeah. I think Thessaly is an interesting character because when I first read it, she's in control of the situation to begin with. And that's quite admirable. She's going on a mission to save Barbie, or to which saving Barbie will probably be the byproduct, shall we say? Because,
yes.
And then at the end, she sort of gets a telling off from Dream. Dream is very sort of dismissive of what she's done and the problem she has caused. And one of the problems she has caused is that she has brought the moon down and created the sort of tidal problem that's created weather that leads to the end of the book.
Yes.
The storm at the end of the book that kills, I think, kills Wanda and kills another person.
Yeah.
And so when I went back and read it again recently, the thing about Thesley was I realised she's the villain. She acts selfishly. Her vengeance is about herself. And she causes a tragedy. She causes the death of Wanda and Maisie Hill at the end of the book. That is her doing. And yeah. I think that's very interesting that that's one of the things that informed my reading of her this time round is that one of the things she demonstrates is intense transphobia against Wanda, because I think this is one of the places where the Game of You has been criticised quite a lot, is that even in the world of witches and fantasy dream world, Wanda's status of a trans woman isn't accepted. So the way that Thessaly, Fox and Hazel are able to travel to the dream world, they use the moon path, they use their womanhood, supposedly, their connection to the moon, their spiritual or witchcraft connection to the moon. And Wanda is excluded from that because, and this is Thessaly says, very declaratively, Wanda is a man.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is not true. Wanda is a trans woman. And so, for me, actually reading it, I was like, well, Thessaly is sort of, she has these characteristics of transphobia that we now, like, I think now we can sort of point to. You know, they are the villain of the piece. And I think that shifted my reading of this, of the comic book, to think about Thessaly as the villain straight out. I think that's changed for me reading
right.
that.
Right, okay. I mean, that's very interesting, because we're going to talk about the characters. In summary, characters get drawn into this dreamlike world for a variety of reasons. Thessaly is clearly on a path of revenge. Fox and Hazel are there to sort of try and help Barbie. And it leaves Wanda behind in real world New York as the sort of protector of Barbie. We should say that George, the creepy neighbour who starts the events off, is sort of brought back to a sort of terrible life by Thessaly in order to give her information. And then after Thessaly, Fox and Hazel disappear into the dream world, Wanda is able to speak to George. And again, it's interesting because George sort of denies Wanda her trans status.
Yeah.
Again, he makes the point, it's the moon. The moon regards you as a man. It's a chromosomal thing.
Yeah.
So there's Well, in fact, I suppose there's several characters in the Game View storyline who reject Wanda's status. Barbie gives us our best example, I think, of just, you know, complete acceptance, complete friendship. They clearly rely on each other for, you know, quite a lot mm-hmm. in this book, even though it's only drawn out in the first few pages, I think, of the first issue. And then again, you know, because we're heading for a funeral scene at the end of the sixth issue. Okay, so, I mean, this is something I've particularly had to get used to, is this idea of diversity and representation. And when I read A Game of You in the last week, and again last night for this podcast, I wondered what the title meant, A Game of You. And I took some clues from Samuel Delaney's introduction, where he says, this story of the Sandman, this particular part of the Sandman, is about identity. Mm-hmm. And it's about what identity means in 1991, and I think what identity means now. It tells us a little something. It gives us insights into people's identity and how much we rely on others to help us with our own identities, and how much perhaps Wanda relies on Barbie And probably Fox and Hazel, I think. But as you say, Thessaly and George deny her a status, mm-hmm. don't they? They deny her her identity, as, of course, tragically, do her own family. Who it's hinted at throughout the story, and then we see at the funeral, completely reject Wanda's identity as a trans woman. They regard her as their son who they've lost, who's been taken away to sinful ways in that sinful city, New York. So, I mean, that's what I took from it reading it recently, you know, that the stuff about relationships, the stuff about identity was really important. It's got this nice little fantasy world where you've got toy characters who come to life, and there's a sort of a quest. And as you say, there's a couple of villains. There's the cuckoo, who perhaps turns out not to be quite as villainous. Thessaly, who's just all about Thessaly, basically. And just, you know, somebody has done a wrong against me. I want to find out who it is and then kill them. But along the way, I'm going to make very blunt comments about Barbie, Wanda, Hazel, Fox, George, all these other characters in the same house. Is it... I mean, let's turn to some more of the troubling aspects of it, because, again, Samuel R. Delaney, in his introduction, points out that there are, in this particular arc of Sandman, there is one black character, or one person of colour, I should perhaps use the phrase, and one trans character. And you talked about this with Halo Jones. You have characters, diverse characters, and what often happens to them in genre is...
they die.
They get killed. Mm. They die, yes. And both the black character, who you mentioned already, this can I call her a bag lady in New York? A homeless person.
I think
person.
In New York, the term crazies is used quite often. I think it's used in A Game of You as well. But yeah, I guess she's a person who seems to be homeless.
She seems to be homeless. She seems to have mental health issues. She's what New York, as you say, would call a crazy on the subway, mm-hmm. Shouting at the world. I mean, she's not shouting at the world, but she's just got this thing. She's got a phobia of dogs. And when this, of course, that leads to a nice comic issue or comic page when this huge dog-like, teddy bear-like fantasy character called Martin Tenbones arrives in New York mm-hmm. with the magical device. Okay, so that's Maisie Hill. So she's the person of colour, and Wanda is the trans woman, and they both get killed.
Yeah.
And they both end up dead. They're the only ones in, and they end up dead. So it's 1991, and we're now 2018. I just wondered, have we got any better at that in the last 17 years?
Well, I think it's interesting, because I think we talked about this a little bit with Halo Jones, this idea that these representations, say, should we take the trope of trans characters or queer characters dying that became quite prevalent. And I was sort of thinking about that idea of where tropes come from. Obviously, tropes don't just spring out from nowhere. They come because of reinforcements from popular culture, like repeated trips to repeated, like, narratives that stay the same or, you know, are subtly changed, but always end up the same way. And so A Game of You fits into that role because it fits into the trope. But it also, as I mentioned earlier, it bucks the trend because it is the first time I read a trans character, and it is, for lots of people, the first time that happens in a, like, relatively mainstream comic book. And to think about the early 90s, I would be thinking about film because that's my area of specialty. And at this point in sort of film culture, there is the beginnings of what became known as new queer cinema. And so one film that struck me as being particularly relevant, and I don't know if Neil Gaiman saw the film or was aware of it, or even if it had any bearing on the film, but is the film Paris is Burning.
Oh, right.
So it's a documentary about drag culture in New York, particularly drag culture to do with people of colour, mostly. But it features several trans characters, several people who engage in drag culture, and all the people in it. And it also, you know, it was one of those films that exposed non-queer people to queer culture.
Right.
And it deals with issues of being a trans woman at that point in time, including a tragic death, which is sort of echoed. Maisie Hill talks about in A Game of You, talks about a nephew, I think, who was trans and also died. And that story of how trans people die is very true. I think it does happen. Trans people of colour have a higher rate of death, which is very sad and shouldn't happen. But to think about this moment in 1991, where that sort of, I don't really know where I'm going with this, but that those ideas were beginning, representation was beginning to happen more and more. But also the truth of the matter is, and the truth of the matter now still is, that trans people of colour, and trans people of colour are often the victims of murder or tragic death or
violent death.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think we talked about this with Hayley Jones as well, but this idea that you can't, I think Samuel R. Delaney also says, you can't just write something like, you know, you can't write it off because it conforms to this trope. It's still very important. And it's still, as I said, like, Wanda is still a fully realised character in the way that a lot of other representations of trans people are not. Mm. But I just thought it was interesting to think about that time in 1991 when this was coming out, about what was beginning to, you know, these stories were beginning to come into the mainstream culture. And this is one of them.
Yes.
Talking about now, I think there's more representation in comic books of trans people, but there's still some ideas still persist about it, so it remains sort of on the fringes of things.
Yeah.
I went back to an article that I read when we were talking about Hayley Jones, because we were talking about representations of gender non-conforming characters. And this is the article where I was reading about the character from The Runaways, Zavin, I believe, who could be described as gender non-conforming or gender fluid. And this article is from Autostraddle.
Okay.
It's from 2015. And that brings up... So there's a trans character in Batgirl.
Right.
Who is the roommate of Batgirl.
Oh, good.
And
right.
Her best friend. And that was sort of pointed to by this author as sort of a beginning of sensitive representations that allowed for trans people to be fully, like, humanized in the way that they are not usually in comic books. And they also pointed to Lumberjanes,
right,
which is a comic book I love,
yes,
where one of the central Lumberjanes is trans, and it's not an issue that comes up a lot in the comic. It's not like A Game of You, where every other page we're going to be talking about Wanda's gender. But it's brought up briefly and is acknowledged in a very subtle and very kind of beautiful way, which for a comic book that's aimed at all ages is very important and really good, I think. And then also to look at works like Bitch Planet, which I think a couple of people mentioned after the Hayley Jones podcast, as being the place where good female representation and good trans female representation is sort of represented the most in comic books at the moment.
Yes. Okay. Bitch Planet, is that Kelly Sue DeConnick?
Mm-hmm.
And Lumberjanes,
yes.
Who's the creator of Lumberjanes?
Lumberjanes is Noel Stevenson and Shannon Waters.
Right. Okay.
Look that up.
Cool. I'm aware of them, but I haven't really read much of them, unfortunately. Okay, because I mean, it's interesting what you say about Wanda. I'm thinking back. There were characters, I suppose, not characters, there were real people who would make the news headlines, real trans people who would make the news headlines in the 80s. I'm thinking of one actress who was a sort of background Bond girl in one of the Bond movies who was a trans woman. But I, like yourself, probably Wanda in the comic book The Sandman by Neil Gaiman was probably one of the first depictions of a trans person that I can recall reading about. And reading about her in a way that's just thought, of course she's trans, of course she's a woman, of course she's Wanda.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it felt to me.
Yeah.
You know, it gave me that depiction of a character, and it gave me that feeling of acceptance and understanding. And then it gave me that feeling right at the end of this comic book where she dies and her parents, completely rejecting her status as a trans woman, revert her to their son and bury her as their son, mm-hmm. Alvin. And then this moment, which I talked about in Halo Jones, where Barbie left alone at the graveside after the funeral, where she's been treated fairly badly by the family in a way, apart from Wanda's aunt, who, you know, it was who at least had the courtesy to meet Barbie off the Greyhound bus and talk to her and bring her, you know,
yeah,
give her some hospitality. But anyway, so Barbie's been left alone, and as we said last time, she does this thing where she takes out Wanda's favourite coloured lipstick and writes Wanda on the gravestone.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, you know, I still think it's a wonderful moment in comic books. I like moments in comic books, as you can tell, because we're surrounded by them.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, okay, so...
I think that's an interesting moment because it... Unlike other trans characters, Wanda is... Barbie gives Wanda her trans status after death as well. And I think to revisit her after death is sort of a rare thing in terms of that trope, you know, that the tragic death happens and then you move on from it.
Yes.
The idea being that the audience can move on from it too. But this, A Game of You sort of doesn't really let you move on from it because that's how the book has to end. The book has to end with reminding you about this, about Wanda, but also reminding you about the hate and rejection that Wanda faced in her life. Interestingly, in the introduction by Samuel R. Delaney, he talks about the lipstick being a sort of impermanent thing. It will get washed away and disappear.
Yes, that's right. The first rainstorm will take it away.
I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about another queer person, Oscar Wilde, who's famously, his tombstone is in constant need of upkeep because of the lipstick kisses that people apply to it when they visit it. And so this idea that actually lipstick has the potential to damage, you know, if you think about, you know, continuous lipstick kisses can affect something as permanent as a gravestone. And so this idea for me was almost quite a happy one because there's almost a queer intervention here that if Barbie returned or if other people returned and also wrote Wanda on this, Alvin would begin to disappear, and Wanda would become, you know, there's that immortalization there was quite, as a way of reading the text through a queer lens. I think right. That's quite interesting. But yeah, she's given her ending.
Okay. I mean, I just, you know, I'm thinking back to it and thinking just, you know, this idea that I gave this book to you as a teenager, but it was a book that meant something to me. It just seemed like, you know, here is a trans woman. I completely understand and accept, and I get very upset about what her parents and what other characters say or do to her. And, you know, their rejection of her trans status. And it just seemed to me self-evident that this, you know, this was a trans woman and we should, you know, accept her as a trans woman. But, of course, it does have the tropey thing, which you talked about last time, that the trans woman, the person of colour, get killed violently at the end of the comic book. So, You've mentioned a few other comic books. I'm thinking to myself about trans characters in 2000 AD, mm-hmm. or even in the mainstream comics of Marvel and DC. You've mentioned Batgirl. I don't think Marvel have got any trans characters, but I'm not reading any Marvel comics.
I think it's important to note that even if they are there and we don't know about them, it's probably a bad thing, you know, because they're obviously not... No one is pushing them to the forefront in a way that they are, you know, is it very easy to think of a superhero as a cis, male, white person? And obviously that is changing at the moment. Our accepting of superheroes who are female and our accepting of superheroes who are people of colour is beginning to happen. So I think there's potential for it. But yeah, like you said, I can't think of a character who is that lead character.
Yes.
In anywhere other than the ones I mentioned, like Lumberjanes and Bitch Planet, which are more... They're more ensemble casts, I guess. There isn't, like, the one lead, but...
As we sit here, Marvel's Black Panther is one of the biggest-selling movies of all time. And, you know, it's fantastic. It's great fun. But I'm aware that Marvel, if the rumours are true, Marvel have, in their cinematic universe, have tried to downplay or take out elements of possible gay relationships. And there is this rumour that there was a depiction of a gay relationship in Black Panther which was taken out.
Yeah.
They didn't want it.
And the depiction of a bisexual character in Thor Ragnarok that they also downplayed.
Right.
I mean, I think the article I mentioned earlier, the author refers to Jessica Jones as sort of the place where queer identities are being presented. And I think it's also crucial to know that Jessica Jones is coming from female creators.
Yeah.
And why it's crucial. I think one of the things I was reading in that article, it's a very good article. I think I'll send the link to you so you can post it out.
I shall post it in the show notes.
Because one of the things the writer mentions is that a lot of the times these characters come, especially in the mainstream, they come from the ordinary, like they come from Neil Gaiman, who's a cis man. Or they come from, say, mentioned Wicked and Divines, the Kieran Gillen. And they come from these people, but they come from consultation and friendships and working alongside other people, trans people who can inform those characters. And one of the things I literally discovered just earlier when I was flicking through the thank yous at the back of my edition of Game of You, Neil Gaiman thanks Don Melia.
Yes.
And his unnamed just as late roommate who planted the seed that became Wanda. That's the quote.
Yes.
And so I looked at to who Don Melia was, and he was involved in publicising like queer comics, underground queer comics in the UK. And he also working with lots of British comic book writers and artists that we'd recognise, but also publicising comic books about AIDS and fundraising for AIDS. And I thought, that's interesting because obviously Neil Gaiman had an awareness and a friendship and worked alongside people who were involved in the queer community, and that informed Wanda. And I think it's probably why, one, because Neil Gaiman is a very good writer, but two, because he had real world people to draw from that led to Wanda being such a well, like, versed character, you know, such a well-rounded and interesting character.
Yeah.
And I think that continues to the present day, where people are not just sort of resting on their laurels, you know, to say, I can write any character, but saying, I need help to write this character and write this character well. Or to even say, I can't write this character, a trans person should be writing this character, you know, or, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's more and more people, trans people and people seeking help from the queer community to write their characters. And I think that's beginning to sort of bubble up in comic books and sort of pop culture in general.
Yes. Okay. Have you seen, I mean, you mentioned comics about AIDS. Have you seen DC's comic that they did about AIDS where they had Dream Sister Death? You've got it here.
I literally went and looked for it because I thought, I wondered how whether there was a direct connection there. And that this was 1994, this came out. A Vertigo PSA about prevention of AIDS with Death, Dream's sister, and John Constantine.
Yeah, so John Constantine, another DC character created by Alan Moore in Swamp Thing, another one of my favourite comics. And yes, and she gets John Constantine to help her demonstrate how to put a condom on a banana. Yep. John Constantine is incredibly embarrassed by it for some reason. But Death, they're taught, yes. You know, I mean, we haven't mentioned Dream's sister Death, who is one of the sort of surprise hits of the Sandman comic in a way, because she was portrayed throughout the 75 issues mostly as this sort of quirky, cute goth girl. Black hair and a weird amulet, and
I think, as I remember reading something written by Neil Gaiman ages ago about how Death for him was the idea that when you died you'd like to meet a friendly face,
yes,
someone who you'd want to see and see again. It's that idea that Death becomes a friendly, nice person who is kind, and also the fact that she becomes the most, you know, I think it's fair to say she's the most loved character in The Sandman.
Yes.
It's very interesting that he succeeded so well that she actually took on a life beyond Dream, you know, the role that Dream has.
Yeah.
I think it's, I mean, we didn't really talk much about Dream or Death or anyone else, the Endless or The Sandman. Like, we didn't talk about Dream at all in this comic book that is about Dream.
Well, it's the comic book called The Sandman. This particular story arc does that thing that they sometimes do with Judge Dredd, which we've talked about, obviously, many a time on this podcast, which is they write a comic where Judge Dredd's not in it very much.
Yeah.
And so the Game of You, Dream is not in it very much. He turns up at the end to sort of dismantle this fantasy land in the Dream Inn, and he's pretty cross with everybody. You know, he's upset with everybody about it in a way that Dream gets upset. But there's also, obviously, Barbie survives A Game of You. And we learn early on that Barbie, since the events of something that happened earlier on in the Sandman run in a story called The Doll's House, or A Doll's House, that Barbie doesn't dream anymore. And at the end of the book, end of A Game of You, she's dreaming again. And she has this dream about Wanda, where Wanda looks like... she looks like Wanda, and she's with this cute, quirky, goth girl who waves at, and they both wave at Barbie.
Yeah.
And he has, you know, so Dream, a Dream's sister Death does turn up in this very briefly, and she delivers a wonderful, you know, moment in Barbie's dream. But Dream Morpheus...
Murphy,
as he's referred to in the Fantasyland. So they sort of swear by Murphy or things like that, don't they? And it turns out to be they're talking about Morpheus, the Dream King, who turns up at the end to sort of you know, it's like the ruby slippers. He turns up at the end to you know,
to present the options for an ending.
Yes. To wrap things up in a way, to return Barbie and Fox and Hazel and Thessaly to the comic book version of New York, and to have words with Thessaly, who you know, and so on.
I think Dream is an interesting character, and one of the things I was thinking about reading this recently is my perception of Dream has maybe changed slightly. Because one of the things that I sort of hinted at earlier, this idea that this land was not Barbie's originally. No. This land belonged to a former lover of Dream. And I think throughout the Sandman series, this idea that Dream has collected lovers and women who he's got bored of, or women who have broken his heart, comes up and up and up and up again. In fact, I think it even is hinted that Thessaly... engages in a relationship with him and is possibly the person who leaves at the beginning of Brief Lives.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes.
This idea that Dream is collecting, or no, I don't know, collecting, but like engages in multiple affairs with women, and these lead to like painful moments where he has to deal with them.
Mm.
And I like I don't know if I like the idea of it, but this idea that this land that he created for his for this ex-lover, he now has to get rid of, and he doesn't want to get rid of it. And it reminds me a little bit of that bit in Parks and Rec where Anne has to clear out her boyfriend boxes.
Yeah.
You know, this like idea that you've got this part of another person, you need to get rid of it, and Dream can't do that. And so I quite, reading it again, I was sort of, I think when I first read it, Dream was sort of a romantic hero. And when I was reading it again, Dream is kind of grumpy and putting things off and not dealing with them and being very like emotional about things, but in a not very practical way. And I think it's quite interesting that my reading of Dream in this story had changed a little bit, you know. And at the end, he's kind of non-committal, and he'll tell Thessaly off, but he won't deal with the situation. He is, you know.
You never, throughout the 75 issues, I don't think you ever see Dream in a relationship with a woman. You always see him after a relationship.
Yeah.
And he treats his exes pretty terribly and horribly throughout.
He does.
You know.
And I think it was interesting, we talked about the characters, Neil Gaiman not wasting any minor characters, because Barbie comes back in and Foxglove is a character who's linked to a previous character.
Judy.
And Fox and Hazel will go on to be brought up later, I think, as well. And I think there is definitely something to the Sandman that women get tangled up in his dealings. Women get affected, I think, disproportionately to men. He has camaraderie with male characters, friendships with male characters, but with women, there's a lot of the times they get sort of embroiled in his world and damaged by it,
yes,
or changed by it. So yeah. Barbie is a key one, because Barbie, you know, the things that lead to the plot, the sort of narrative that leads to what happens in a doll's house is sort of slightly created by Dream.
Yeah.
And then that leads to her losing her dreams, which leads to this. So it leads to her being connected and controlled more. And
yeah,
that also is what happens. That's this Fox's connection is also to what Dream sort of set off in motion at the beginning of the series. And there's a lot of interesting female characters in The Sandman, but there's also a lot of characters who are female characters who are changed and damaged by their connection,
yes,
with the Sandman. And I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because the amount of female characters in it make it a very good read, but also that ever-present sort of damaging influence of Dream becomes quite, reading it now, I think I see it more, but like it's throughout the series, I think there's this element of women being sort of caught up in his dealings.
Yes, you know, you're making me think about it, because it's a book called The Sandman. It's about Dream Morpheus, the Dream King. He is a gloomy and somewhat toxic, you might disagree with the somewhat toxic male character in a book, as you say, where the lives of a lot of female characters are altered by him, and not, you know, not in a good way. And he's the miserable, gloomy one, and his sister Death, who for some reason, you know, she is the cheerful, perky one, the one who has positive outlook, who sees the best in everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and who is there to meet people when they die and to celebrate their, their lifetime. There's that wonderful issue early on. I think it was the one. So there's the first run of Sandman, which is called, I think, Preludes and Nocturnes, which is about him being trapped and about him being, he escapes and about his return to his kingdom. And it ends with an issue called, I think, The Sand of Her Wings, which introduces his sister. And there's it's all this stuff about Mary Poppins, and she's took, because Death loves the film Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm. And it's a fantastic issue, and it sort of like set as you say, Death as this fan favourite who still is everybody, just about everybody's favourite character from the Sandman comics. But yeah, okay. Fascinating. Yeah, he is a gloomy, grumpy, toxic male. All right, let's go back to a game of you. Let's we've ranged all over the place. Any favourite moments or individual issues from A Game of You or any particular characters? Obviously, we've talked at length about Barbie and Wanda as being a fantastic depiction of a pair of friends in New York struggling to get by, but having, you know, being great friends. Favourite bits?
I don't know if there's a particular issue that I like. I like the sort of fantasy adventure journey through the woods that Princess Barbie takes with various toys. I think that, let's see what issue number that is.
It's great fun, isn't
issue
it?
Issue 4. It's the one I think that feels very reminiscent of a lot of like other pieces of literature, and is kind of one of those places where you can spot things. And you know, even the idea of the like evil characters, they feel very familiar, you know, this sort of like,
yes, so there's the Dark Guard or the Black Guard,
the Black
or
Guard
called.
And the tweeners, yes. And these sort of little bits, little hints of the world.
There's a path
beyond,
which is not
this
quite
story.
It's not, yeah, quite the Olympic Road. They even say it's not yellow or brick, but it's a path.
Yeah.
And then she's traveling with these wonderful characters based on her childhood toys. So one's a monkey in a sort of in a cute hat. There's a parrot, or I don't know what is he, some sort of parakeet with a bow tie and a bib.
He's meant to be I think actually she, and she's meant to be a dodo.
She's a dodo, sorry. And then there's Wilkinson, who's a rat in a sort of private detective slouch hat and trench coat, who comes from a family of 14 kids, all called Wilkinson.
Yeah.
which he said was, you know, tough on the girls. And again, Samuel Delaney refers to that as, you know, this thing about identity and names, which is interesting.
I think, I don't know, there's lots of little moments that are great from the beginning. I think one of the strong things about the book is it doesn't feel like any moment is wasted. And even when they're sort of, you know, even the dreams of Wanda and Hazel and Fox at the beginning, these are just, you know, these are just they're examples of bad dreams. They're just to show you what the cuckoo is doing and giving these bad dreams to these people. But they're also very rich and complex in a way that, you know, they're not what we would think of as standard. You know, there's no teeth falling out, there's no falling downstairs, there's, you know, Wanda's is about her embodied experience as trans, but also her childhood. Hazel's is about her current situation being unexpectedly pregnant and her fears about that. And Fox is about her history with an ex who, you know, she has a complicated history with her. And I think using that as a, like, you know, this idea that you're going to give each of these characters their worst ever dream, their nightmare, you know, their worst experience, but to also use that as a moment to give them a little bit more depth as character, I think is one of the like strongest points of maybe the Sandman in general, but A Game of You specifically.
Yeah, and they're only 2 pages each for the, yeah, dreams, and then yet they're sort of, they're all brilliant and nightmarish, and you can sort of see them as nightmares. You know, you can think, oh yes, I can think how that would be terrible, you know, or something like that in dreams. Okay, we haven't, I mean, I know we're running long a bit here, but we haven't mentioned the artwork at all. I hadn't quite remembered that the artwork, I mean, obviously there was a number of artists over the run of the Sandman, and often you would get one artist would do one arc of the Sandman, but here I hadn't quite remembered that it changes from Sean McManus fairly early on. I think the first couple of issues possibly by Sean McManus, and then we get one by Colleen Doran, then we're back to McManus for the sort of trip through the fantasy land, and then Brian Talbot turns up, who's a, you know, 2000 AD creator, but also very famous now for his own comics and graphic novels. We've had, you know, we've done him on the podcast, The Tale of One Bad Rat and Alice in Sunderland, which is perhaps his magnum opus. He's going to come up at some point in the future. Any particular examples of the art that you, you know, you really liked or that stood out for you?
Well, this is weird because I was actually looking through some of my old, you know, just like scrapbooks and stuff.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of scrapbooks filled with photocopied images from A Brief Lives, which is definitely my favourite collection because Delirium is one of my favourite characters ever. But I also had many photocopied pages from this and drawings of the characters. And so these early drawings of Barbie with her face painted like a checkerboard and the final scenes where she has the veil drawn on her face, those I had, those depictions I had, and I think those are still sort of the strongest for me. I think early on there's one with the cute frog mug.
Yes.
I think that's, you know, that's one of my favourite pages of the book because it's that back and forth between Wanda and Barbie and that sort of slightly strange little bits of comedy from the little frog mug and the, like, her face. You know, Wanda says, "What are we today then?" when she sees Barbie's checkerboard face, and she says, "I'm a chessboard and you're just tacky, Wanda." And I think that's very nice, very, like, authentic bit of dialogue.
Yeah.
That sort of establishes them.
Okay. Let's stick with A Game of You for just a moment longer. Do you have a favourite page? Would you be able to pick a Grail page from the six issues? Or even if I gave you the Dave McKean covers, which are all glorious, and he writes, I mean, I know, I read an interview where he wrote he was doing all sorts of weird things, abusing a colour photocopier, is what he said, doing all the things they told you not to do in the instructions. And he does these wonderful photo collage covers, and some of them, you know, I think he's produced different covers for the trade collections, because you and I have got different editions.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. A Grail page, Jenny?
I think the one I mentioned there with Wanda and Barbie being happy together, I think I like. I mean, the ending, I was just looking at it again. The multiple pages of the ending are probably some of the best comic book writing ever.
Yeah.
But I can't think of a single one. I mean, the final page with Wanda's tombstone is quite affecting, but I'd prefer to have Wanda alive on my wall if I was going to have one. So I think, yeah, that early one with the cute frog mug.
Okay.
Yeah, and the checkerboard face.
Cool.
That would be the one.
All right. Can I choose for myself? I didn't know what I was going to choose, but I'm going to actually pick the image of the dream of Wanda and Death at the end of the comic, where Barbie falls asleep on the Greyhound bus and she dreams and Wanda appears and there is Death with her. Mm-hmm. And just looking, your copy is, that's quite an older copy because it's the colours have faded a bit perhaps, haven't they? Or is the paper not quite as good?
It's not quite as shiny as yours, I think.
Okay, so that's what I'm going to pick and we'll pop them up on the Facebook page so that people can see what we're talking about. Okay, so it's A Game of You. It is, as I say, volume 5 in the Complete Sandman. It is just fantastic. We've wandered all over the prairie with it, talking about it, but it is wonderful.
I mean, one of the things I actually wrote down to mention, but I didn't get around to it, and now I've lost the quote, is it's fairy tale, and it gives you this, like we talked about, it gives you this sort of literary understanding of fairy tales and magical worlds. It's also incredibly gruesome and, like, violent. And some of the artwork, looking back on it, is, like, quite horrible, especially at the beginning with the bad dreams and Thessaly and George. And I think at one point Wanda says, "We've fallen down the rabbit hole and we've ended up in Stephen King's basement." And I think that's, like, the perfect summation of what this book is, because it combines those two things.
Right.
Combines that, like, magical and the horror. In a way that's, I think you don't notice it when you're reading it, but reading it back, I noticed, like, gruesome babies and gruesome murders, and it stuck out to me a lot more.
The other thing I noticed last night when I was reading it was right at the end of the book, we get this little callback to Halo Jones Just to link it back to our last podcast, Jenny. And I know we've talked about this. So we've got Barbie in the car with Wanda's aunt talking about what she's going to do next and how when she was a kid, she'd go out and when she came back, her mom would say, where have you been? And she'd say, out. What have you been doing? Nothing. So she says, that's what I'm going to do. Where am I going? Out. What am I going to do? Nothing. And it's a slight, well, I think it's an obvious reference to Halo Jones,
who of course
famously went out and did everything. Let's stick with Sandman just for a moment longer, because I asked you to pick your favourite single issue from Sandman and also your favourite story arc. Now, I think you've said the favourite story arc already, which is...
Brief Lives.
Which happens, I don't know, must be about...
It's towards the end, because it's what sets off the end, I think. Right?
Yes.
The end,
yeah, it sets off another story, which is called The Kindly Ones. But yeah, Brief Lives, which I guess must be volume 7 or 8 or something like that. Okay, and favourite single issue of The Sandman?
It's volume 7.
It's volume 7, here it is. It's volume 7. Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I couldn't think... I would probably take any issue of Brief Lives because I really do like it a lot. But I remembered an issue... I don't know where it falls, actually, in the series, but it's called 3 Septembers and a January. And it centres around this sort of... the figure of the Emperor of the United States.
Yes.
This sort of, like, little bit of, I guess, modern folklore, almost, of this man who declared himself the Emperor of the United States. And it takes the involvement of dream and, I think, desire and despair... get involved as well, and they sort of have a wager about who can control his life the most.
Yes.
I think Mark Twain appear in it as well?
Yeah,
Mark Twain's in it. It has lots of little nods to history, and I remember that story being quite interesting, and I think it's the one I can sort of remember the whole story, if that makes sense. I can remember the bits when desire comes in, the bits when despair comes in, the end when death comes in, and I think, yeah.
Okay.
That's my favourite.
So that is 3 Septembers and a January, and it's also, I see, drawn by Sean McManus. My favourite issue, I don't know the number, it's very near the end of the 75 issues. It's called The Wake, and it's about a character called Hob Gadlin, and he is dealing with the death of a friend. And as you can tell, I sometimes get very moved by comic book stuff. And popular culture in general. But this, I found that one very moving. But I won't spoil too much about it because, you know, for 2000 AD readers who haven't read The Sandman, is it one of the greatest comic book series of all time, would you say?
I think so. I think it almost straddles that line between the comic books that carry on indefinitely forever and ever.
Yeah.
And the comic books that are short runs... designed to end in a few issues because it has the sort of has the length that makes it seem like it's going to carry on, but it also has this like overarching narrative that means it can't continue forever. I think it is. I think it's definitely one of my favorites. It's the one I recommend to people most frequently, and I usually recommend that they start with A Game of You because that's where I started, and I think that gives you a way into the story without having to worry about, you know, being invested in the characters straight away.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, people talk about those great 80s graphic novels, Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns, Mouse, which perhaps is more significant than the first two. And Sandman, because it's 75 issues, because it's this huge, sprawling epic about stories and fables and so on. I just think sometimes it should be mentioned before those, or certainly before Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns, which have become increasingly problematic as the years have gone by.
I think it's fair. I think Sandman builds to the present moment more than those do. I think Watchmen maybe has moments where it seems to be very telling about like the modern world, but actually... I think Sandman captures that moment in the like early 90s, but also brings you into where we are now. I don't know. I think it's better. You know, maybe that's just because there's better representation in it, so I connect more to the stories than I do in Watchmen, where I'm limited to very few female characters, and those female characters don't necessarily get the best treatment. So I think, yeah, I think Sandman is important for me, and I think it's important for other people as well.
Yeah, I think it is a very important comic. And yeah, epic stuff by Neil Gaiman, fantastic. Okay, I hope my listeners will tolerate with the fact that we wandered off the 2000 AD prairie by quite some, you know, distance, and we've been all over the place with a game of you. We've gone on longer than I thought we perhaps would, but anyway, I hope I haven't put you off too much by, you know, grilling you with microphones twice now, and you know, who knows, you may come back to the book club again in the future. I guess that'll do us.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find us on Apple Podcasts. Find out more about the podcast on Facebook or on the 2000 AD forums or on Twitter, or by emailing me mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And as ever, all the episodes and all the links are at megacitybookclub.com. And that will do us. So until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we'll be passing judgment on another fine book, probably will be 2000 AD next time. Thank you very much for listening, and it's goodbye from me. And
it's goodbye from me. Wow.